Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, last minute packing, got my passports, got my music. We're off to Norway to work with our great friend Bjarte Eike and his group Baroque Solistina that we've worked with for about 16 years to do a program called Naughty Boys, Runny Nose and Spider Bites for reasons that may or may not become apparent. And just packing, got my passport, got my music, got all their music all figured up and ready. Got the fluffy halos, the lighting up horns, the Devil's T-shirts and Charles's loose jacket. Right, any music you hear on this episode that isn't back announced is almost certainly by Baroque Solistina from their album The Alehouse Sessions, or The Playhouse Sessions. Off we go.
Unexpected cadence in bagging area.
It's a day later, and everything's gone swimmingly. We had a lovely rehearsal in London, Monteverdi, Vecchi, Britain, all sorts of bits and pieces. And then, although it was up very early this morning, got through Heathrow easily, lovely flight, very smooth. They couldn't have got rid of us faster at Oslo Airport onto this sleek train. snaking through the snow-clad Norwegian countryside. I'm sitting here with Nicholas. Welcome to being on the official staff of Culture Armour, Nicholas.
Great, great honour.
Can I stop calling you Nicholas now? Can I just call you Sammy,
it's,
please?
It's so strange. Can't quite get past it. Not even Nick, Nicholas. Only my mother calls me that when I'm in trouble.
But it is very beautiful. On the other side of the aisle is Charles Gibbs, Matt Long, whose phone just went, another gig. Anna Crook's back with us after not being with us so much towards the end of last year. And another Anna Beard Fernandez, former student, now doing very nicely in London. Thank you. She got a bit of Spanish to sing the next few days. She and you both.
La Jacara, the Iribarren, is that his name? Nice, good piece of Christmas rhythm.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's brought her own castanets.
Indeed.
So it's always the thing in Fagin. If you've got extra skills, we do use them. You got any extra skills?
No, I don't even have any basic skills. Waiting to develop them.
Matt, of course, juggles.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Matt juggles. And so, yes, all beautifully smooth, and it's really, really lovely. Actually, it's not, is it? It's just some houses.
Well, but no, it was a minute ago a really lovely countryside. Can we pretend for the listeners?
Covered in snow. Which is the single Norwegian word for snow.
That's right, on QI a few years ago, they busted that myth that Eskimos have millions of words for snow. What Eskimos do have is millions of words for demonstrative pronouns. So they have a different word for that thing over there as opposed to this thing over here. And that's all. They're all single words, that thing on top of the drawer as opposed to that thing inside the drawer. All these...
Should you ever go there, that'd be useful. Now, at the end of our last thing to go, we had Etymology Corner.
You did.
And you got another one.
Well, yeah, I was thinking about Scandinavia, I was thinking about the Copenhagen, which is obviously not here, but not far away. And I reckon Hagen is fairly straightforward because it's Havn, which is harbour.
Like Haven in English.
Haven, exactly.
So Havn has been Norwegian.
Gone.
No, she's gone.
Just the name of her. The name of a station, but Copen is a little bit less straightforward. Copen with a K in Danish comes from the same root as in Swedish. It goes the K is spread out ch, like killing, like it was just chicken, and it comes from the same root as the German word Kaufen, so shopping harbour. So Copenhagen is shopping harbour. There you go. We need a jingle, I think, for Etymology Corner.
Okay, we'll sort it.
Lovely.
Etymology Corner.
Thanks to Vultures 8 for plucking that one out of thin air. Right, well, that was a really bad idea to boast about how well the travel was going.
I'm not going to say I'm blaming you, but you did say it was going well, and then it really went badly because we waited for about 2 hours in the freezing cold in about a queue of about 1,000 people outside a random station in Norway.
For a bus, which Matt managed to get further up the queue than us, got on a bus after about only an hour, disappeared, and then half an hour came back round the roundabout.
Just came crawling back.
Trying, at which point we sort of lost the will to live. And then the train started running again. So I got back on the train and met Matt at exactly the same time at the next station. Anyway, we're here now. Yeah. And there's an enormous amount of snow, isn't it? I mean, it's piled up to sort of head high where they pushed it to one side in the streets.
Yeah, it's very white, isn't it? Amazing light you get, partly from presumably being up in near the Arctic, but also from the reflecting on the snow. It's very beautiful.
Low sun. We just had we went to a concert last night for our friend Bjarte Eiker's group. They were as baroque solistin. We're on quite a noisy sofa, by the way. It's quite good sort of
leather. It feels quite illustrious, quite expensive.
And we went to their concert, which is the Playhouse Sessions, which is, oh no, have I got that right?
No. It's called Purcell's Playground.
Thank you. The Playhouse Sessions is a development of Ale House, isn't it? And they play under these different names of the Ale House Boys, which you and I used to be a couple of singers for. And that's a sort of what happens when the theatres are closed and Purcell goes into the pubs and they mix Purcell with pub songs and sea shanties and all that, which is an amazing evening. It's been to the UK quite a lot of times.
Yeah, it's brilliant fun, isn't it? I was saying to, I think, Charles last night as we left, you sort of wonder why people bother doing really quite straightforward concerts because they're so much fun and they're so vibrant and they're also so brilliant musically across genres. So the folk stuff is really very beautiful
and the Baroque stuff really kind of really ticks along and is full of life. They're amazing, I think.
And they were playing, it was all off by heart last night, the instrumentalists and everything, and there was this sort of stage dynamic in which they were all moving about, and it just seemed to sort of reflect the music. Soprano Mary Bevan was singing with us, who sang as Eurydice in our Orfeo a couple of years back. She's huge, she's everywhere, but she's such an animal of the stage. Her entire body was given over to the character of the song she was singing.
Yeah, I found myself thinking quite a lot about embodiment watching them, because they kind of dance along, don't they? And or when it's not music that involves dance per se, they move in the same character as the music, and there's something really, really compelling about that. And also just it can't help but be mirrored in the playing and the singing. So really wonderful.
And we were talking about yesterday about how is it that they're happy to improvise. What is it in classical musicians' training, whether improvisation, the natural spirit that we have as children, Where's that cut off? Is it because we don't play as much, or that's a big subject. But you could think, oh, that's because they've got a lot of rehearsal time. They're a properly funded group by Norwegian government. There's all that, but there's something in the mentality, because even when we just sat down to rehearse this Hakara from 1740 today, the thing kicked right from the beginning.
Yeah, they're brilliant, aren't they? And it's almost like they can't help themselves. They started the tarantella kind of ground bass going, and within 20 seconds, because everyone was getting ready, they were kind of rocking on some kind of blues riff, which was just...
It had turned into something else.
Yeah, exactly. Wonderful. Completely different, yeah. And like you say, that sense of freedom that comes with the ability or the willingness to improvise, firstly, is something one doesn't encounter in our line very much, but feels completely authentically Baroque.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the other thing is there's a spirit to the music. Sorry, I'm coughing a bit today. There's a spirit to the music that is clearly as important for them as any idea of what they might have done at the time. Because the point is, we're not people back then, we're people now. And while you and I and they do believe that trying to understand what the composer meant is at least a starting point, point is they're not the composer, they're not then, they are now. And also, if there's one problem with authentic performance, it's the lack of authentic audiences. So our audiences have heard rock and roll, they've heard folk music and all this other stuff, so this, you know, that just bends it. But as you were saying, it's always Purcell, isn't it?
That's it. The it wasn't all Purcell music, was it? There were bits of improvisation, bits of other stuff, I think, like maybe a bit of folky things, but it's so true to Purcell's spirit. And as we were saying on the way here, can't think of many composers who do that incredible range of emotions and of kind of colours, from tragic to comic to bawdy or filthy to exquisite, all within a few bars. And it's a great programme, and it's a great concept what they do, but it wouldn't hit such a bullseye if it weren't brilliantly played all the time.
Yeah. Thank you. the physicalization of it. There was a playing of one of the Vile Fantasias last night. Mm. And they start in four different parts of the stage, three of them off stage, and just gradually coming together as this spider's web is sort of knit. And it just seems so much to embody the tortuous nature of those lines. I always think the trouble with polyphony is it's great if you're in it. I mean, this show Fadge did years ago called Talis in Wonderland. It's all about what it's like to be in polyphony as opposed to what it's like to hear it. And by starting separate, you got much more of the honesty of the individual lines that make up polyphony. And their strange, tortuous nature.
It's deeply weird music, isn't it? He can do that as well as everything else, Purcell. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot recently is the way that notation the fact that we have the music on a page kind of imprisons us a bit, doesn't it? And the way that they're able to have a sort of physical or dramatic or visual representation of what they're doing yesterday on stage makes it a much richer, much more kind of vibrant experience for the audience.
Because the most oral of the audience is still primarily visual.
Yeah.
And even when you're simply watching a symphony orchestra play, you know, I don't mean simply, do I? There's a lot to take in, but it's difficult to sense a sense of development. You are stuck with your ears then, and yeah, that's great. But for that kind of music, there's so much theatricality in it. Anyway, we can talk cleverly about that. But it was very moving, and it was absolutely gripping as well. And it's also an hour until they started encoring, which is a great length for a concert.
Yeah, it's brilliant. No, does anybody ever complain that a concert is too short?
I think King Singers were talking about this after lockdown, that actually doing a two-hour concert, people are very happy with an hour generally.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of time. I think it's a lot to take in, like you're saying, about listening with your eyes as well as your ears. And actually an hour of music, especially when it's relatively complex and when it's performed with such vibrancy as it was last night, that's a lot for our senses to kind of absorb, isn't it?
Yeah. Did you hear a little bit of a Bjarte speaking Norwegian, because we like Norwegian a lot.
We like Norwegian a lot, and we like Bjarte a lot as well.
Apprendre Norvège. Écoutez et répétez.
Luftputebåt. Og den kjører veldig, veldig fort. Luftputebåt. Hovercraft. Luftputebåt. Luft, air, pute, pillow, båt, boat. Luftputebåt. Og den kjører veldig, veldig fort.
He's a terrible musician, though.
Yeah, and also really boring bloke and ugly, which is a shame.
The personal hygiene problem, we were going to talk about that too.
What, Beatus?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's awful. Very smelly. But we like him anyway, despite all that.
And also, just when you thought you'd heard it all last night, they sang.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? So much of last night makes you think about what it is to be an audience. And you and I spend lots of time thinking about how to craft sound and how to make vocal sound into something that really means and lands with an audience. And in fact, hearing their sort of, it's not unfair to call them untrained voices, it's very moving, something really kind of open and generous about that.
It was a very good choice. It was a sleep chorus, yeah, Hush No More. Yeah,
a beautiful bit of the Fairy Queen. Hush No More, be silent all. Sweet repose has closed her eyes. It's really moving.
That kind of hybrid programme where you're choosing separate things from completely unrelated works is a real skill. We'd done one with, actually it wasn't really Fadge, it was Freddie Long and Anna Dennis and Hugo with Academy of Ancient Music. I spent a year and a half going through every single piece he'd written except the keyboard pieces, trying to work out what's an absolute genius piece as opposed to really very, very good piece. But they would have had different choices because of the slightly more funk nature of what they do.
Yeah, they're looking to groove a bit more, I guess. I mean, I'd like to ask you about that. What's the difference between, you know, where did you find the differences? What's the point of the difference between something that is absolutely amazing and astounding and something that's just really, really good?
There are three types of Purcell songs, aren't there? The one is great tunes. If music be the foo-hoo door of love, great tune.
Beautiful song.
Thank you. Then there are the ground bass arias that are incredible. I mean, let's pinpoint, I think the great thing about Purcell ground basses and sometimes Monteverdi ground basses are that his vocal phrases are not the same length as the ground. Even in Arbelinda, which is in first ground bass in Dido Aeneas, it goes on longer than the ground does, and so you lose yourself really in an orgy of oral pleasure. And then there's the more recitative pieces, and it's one of these I've picked for tonight, which Anabid Fernandez is going to sing, which is Urge Me No More, which goes from C major to D flat minor, which is from the theoretically impossible key of F flat minor. And in it, he's just saying, no more music. Everything is too rubbish. Everything is just horrendous. These are not the times to sing of Orpheus. And he goes through these incredible images, and I think that's a truly great song. It's 2 minutes long. You very, very rarely hear it. And I think that was one of the pieces that came out of looking at all this Purcell and thinking that is an extraordinary piece. And it's very little actually about the tune. It goes back to the conversation with Roddy Williams about his Dichterliebe last week, that it was all explaining, trying to make you understand and not dropping the audience for a second just to allow to listen to the music. This was his point about listening to the German. You know, people say, oh, I just come for the music. Well, that's great, but that's not where Schumann started. And with Purcell, he starts with the text. Now you got me onto thinking about them last night.
Oh, yeah.
And they were so unselfconscious. I know Tom Guthrie, a director, baritone, has worked a huge amount with him. He's nearly I'm surprised not to see him there yesterday, actually. And he does Commedia with them. And Steve Player, the dancer, guitarist, who's such a force. I mean, we were talking about what it is to have someone from a different art form on stage. And he's pointed our rehearsal just now is you can't walk off stage like a load of English blokes. There has to be some Tarantella dance feel to it. And we are weighed down as Brits, aren't we, with the potential to be embarrassed. I mean, John Cleese talks about how this is something that powers the whole British psyche, that Fawlty Towers is based on the fear of
fear of embarrassment. And they don't seem to have that at all, Scandinavians.
Do you, Robert?
Yes, but I think the thing about me is...
Loaded question.
I always make sure I'm in control of things or asking you to do the crazy things. So tonight you'll start Sefer Tornow with the video game gag, which I don't think either of you or Matt are particularly keen to do.
We absolutely hate it, yeah.
And it leads into a piece that you also don't particularly like.
Oh, it's the worst piece ever, yeah. No one is a bigger fan of Monteverdi, I don't think, than me, although perhaps you are. And I still think it's my least favourite piece of his.
This is Monteverdi's Zephyr Tona. Cue, let's hear a bit of the piece. What don't you like about it?
Probably somewhere along in the process is that I can't really sing it. I don't know, I just find it a bit... I find that ground a bit annoying. I don't know. I'm not very good at expressing that. It's fine, isn't it? But it's not even the best piece by Monteverdi called Zefiro Torna.
There is another. Yeah.
There's another.
That was where the Victor Police first appeared on. Seeing the score for the first time. Yeah.
If you haven't heard the Zefiro Torna, which is the five-part madrigal from Book 6, please listen to it. It's amazing. It starts off quite innocently, quite sweet, sort of dancing springtime images. But the end, which is the last sort of page or so, is the most... I mean, you were saying the other day you think it's contrived.
It's the most
extraordinary bit of writing for 16...
Okay, we can hear that. Okay. Interesting, two different sonnets to Zefiro Torna.
Yeah, not the same words. Yeah.
First one, Petrarch, doing his eight lines of "Everything's really terrible." Spring. No, sorry, it's the other way around. It's spring returns. Spring returns. Everything is fantastic. Ma per me lasso. Everything is really terrible. I'm going to the bottom of the garden to eat worms. And he does this series of suspensions, which had to say. They're set out a little bit like Pearsall's Leia Garland, which is quite a cheap way to set up suspensions.
Nothing wrong with cheap, especially in Norway.
No, quite. I bought a round last night. Things. Big mistake.
Exactly. Another mortgage. No, it's not. It's perhaps not perfectly constructed, but it's one of those pieces that an audience will always take away with them because it's so extraordinary, particularly in the context of the relatively... like diatonic, which precedes it, this final kind of everything, all these lovely beasts of the field are just a desert to me. It's incredible writing.
Sono un deserto, and he nicks that start from Marenzio and Jacques de Vert, both of whom have set it, and do that da 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 boom, trying to get as far away into the desert from the previous note.
Yeah.
I'm still enjoying this leather.
I wonder if the listeners are. That was the end of Zefiro Torna, the better version, five-part version, from a disc called...
Sweet Torment.
Sweet Torment, which we recorded with, in fact, Baroque Solisna in about 2009 in Oxford. And Bjarte, the hardy Norwegian, was terrorised by the cold church in Oxford.
Yes, and Michael's... Michael's...
Summertown?
Summertown, that's right. And he said, don't you heat your churches here? He doesn't talk like that at all. But and he said, no way, we heat our churches and we're responsible for most of global warming.
Exactly. It was cold, wasn't it? So where were we? End of January. What have you been up to so far this year, Robert?
It's sort of knock on end of that really quite busy term last year when we were away with Fadge, but I was also doing undergraduate teaching. I finished my module called Singing Monteverdi, where students of very different abilities get to grips with what's really important in singing Monteverdi. And you kindly came up and coached on that for a day. And it was just fascinating to see the different sort of things they did. And, you know, obviously they all come with different skills and different experiences of music before. Certainly in universities now, you don't necessarily have to have a music A level to study music at a university. Theory, you know, grade 5 theory, grade 8 theory. But, you know, one of the most impressive things was a student who was certainly difficult. The actual learning notes was difficult. But their presentation was everything that you need for Monteverdi. Their honesty, the fact that they'd really thought about the energy, what's behind this, the way they stood up for, you know, they thought to sit down so they could stand up to raise the tension at one point. So that was lovely to see. As one soprano sounded disturbingly like Emma Kirkby. Nice.
Not a bad thing, we should clarify.
Absolutely not. No, the great Emma. I'm going to genuflect quickly now.
Absolutely, yeah.
The great Dame Emma, sorry. Pop Dame,
a leathery genuflection there.
So that was rather lovely to see. I've written those up, got them moderated. It's quite good marking recitals at University of York because you have really good criteria to fit to. Because marking performance, I mean, you're doing it at the Academy, and it's quite... You said at Cambridge last year when you were marking that still, despite lockdowns and everything, you knew what was a 60 and you knew what was a 70. And we put that into words in York, and it's terribly useful when you're arguing about a mark for a student to have these things to refer to.
Yeah, it's super useful, isn't it? We were talking about it actually just at lunch there, that the criteria are a really good thing to hang your hat on partly because at undergrad, I don't think it's unfair to say, you've got such a range of approaches, such a range of standards, particularly for singers who are, I remember Nick Clapton saying this at Dartington once, that if you're 20, vocally you're basically a toddler, you're 4 or 5 years old in terms of your actual voice having reached its maturity,
especially for men.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, it's totally feasible to be a absolutely international concert standard cellist, which we had at Cambridge a couple of years ago, you know, a former young musician, but you can't, singers, it just almost never works like that. You very rarely get someone who's absolutely ready to go at that stage, so those criteria really help you hang on what you're looking for, really, and what sort of things you're looking to encourage. And it may be that the technical command, if that's the right phrase, isn't where it might be, but the, like you talk about, so the sincerity and the directness of communication
and understanding the music. And yeah. So one of the early 17th century techniques is a throat articulated ornamentation, a whole series of them known as gorgie, throaties, if you like.
Gorgeous.
And one absolutely wouldn't expect singers after a term's work to have done very well with that, but we do want them to engage in it. In fact, one of them produced some fantastic little passaggi at the end. I also got them to rewrite some of the passaggi because, you know, someone like Caccini will write these great big long roulades, double roulades. No one knows what he means by double roulades, but I'm hoping it's got something to do with Swiss roll. Yeah. And you can't do that. That's a lifetime's work to manage that kind of thing. So they just rewrote them, made them shorter, something that had the gesture.
That's a really good exercise, isn't it? Sorry, because it's, you know, these things that have come down to us written down, like, look, Caccini is a good example. It's just one person writing on one day, isn't it? We of course, attach importance to them because they're important documents, but it's only one person's answer to a problem for one performer, I think, most likely.
Try to ask Bjarte to play the cadence the same way twice, or you to ornament something. I mean, you're an absolute nightmare to record because you ornament.
Thank you very much.
Because you ornament different every single time. One of your best ornaments is on Flaming Heart, and you were just basically taking the piss at the beginning of a take in the bit we didn't use, and I managed to slice it on.
Oh, wow.
I wonder if I can just pop that in now. I think I know where that is. So hooray for University of York. That I mean, when I was at university, performance wasn't taught or coached in any way. We had singing lessons. So York's focus on performance, assessed performance, I think is good.
Yeah, and it, as you say, I'm going to Cambridge a little bit now, and it's, but they're beginning to be more explicit about it there and also offer provision for it. Because when I was, I didn't do a music degree, but when I was there, if you did and you did performance, you just kind of left to your own devices, maybe had some lessons outside of, maybe you went down to London for lessons and had to magic up a kind of brilliant 30-minute recital at the end of your degree, having not really been offered any support on it. And that's a very strange way to do things, isn't it?
At Swindon University, they're left to their own devices.
Very good.
Bit of music.
When I was a little boy, oh, so my mama told me,
Jimmy,
way, all the way, we'll haul away, Joe. If I did not kiss the girls, my lips would all go moldy. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. Away, haul away, the good ship now is rolling. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. Charlie, he was England's king before the revolution. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. But then he got his head cut off, it spoiled his constitution. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe. Where? Haul away, we'll haul for better weather, Jimmy. He stopped a spear pouring,
Jimmy. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe.
But now the Charlie's back again, we'll go once more a whoring,
Jimmy. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe.
Away,
haul away, we'll haul for better weather, Jimmy. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe.
Away,
haul away, we'll haul away together, Jimmy. Away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe.
Come on, everybody.
Away.
Så deprimert. I'm really, really depressed. Jeg så deprimert.
We're back on the same noisy leather chairs, but
Nicholas, Sammy's gone, and I'm here with Bjartai. He's just appeared out of thin air, and we've been actually setting the world to rights, but all sorts of things. And you started talking about this thing that you'd done 200 shows. I mean, I know everything you do because I stalk you on on Facebook or whatever with Brock Solistin and Alehouse Boys. What's that that you do?
It's a children's production that I made with another violinist called Peter Spiski. So one of the things we developed was this duo program, which is an alternative Gulliver's Travel. So
you dressed up?
We are dressed up. We have a map as our backdrop where which shows where we travel. So the whole thing is that we actually traveled with him, and we never get any credit for it. And we're there to tell the real story where we went, and so we're traveling with him, and then at the end we lose him, and it's for kids from 6 to 12 years old, I think our audience is, and we run around like crazy. It's a fun little show that we have been touring on schools in Norway. We've done 222 shows.
It's just staggering. I mean, and you said there's this thing called the. You said it's not in an ideal place for music education in some ways, Norway, but you have this thing called the cultural backpack.
Yes, it's an incredible program. So you have all these different regions in Norway called fylker. So, and they all have an administration and a producing team for this cultural backpack, and they are in their main objective is to present professional musicians, dancers, actors. It can be groups, it can be single people, it can be also writers and journalists, and they arrange these tours, talk to the schools, and then you are maybe on a 2 weeks tour, maybe then you go and visit the school and you do a couple of shows. If you are sort of
If you had good feedback.
Yeah, then you are sort of in.
Because kids, not an easy audience.
No, and with our Alehouse project, we are also doing that. It's called the DKS, Den Kulturelle Skolesekken, the Cultural Backpack.
And is it called Orange Juice Project?
Yeah, well, we're not talking too much about the ale part of it. But
which in Norwegian is?
Øl.
Øl.
Ølhus. Ølhus. But, yeah, so we don't, if there's any songs which has the word ale, I turn it into orange juice or something, yeah, but milk. But touring with the Alehouse is interesting, because then you can do this immersive, you can have a little bit older kids, and you can teach them songs and dances and bring them in. And in some places, we even bring them in to then join in for the evening concerts. We did something similar in Cardiff at the Royal Welsh College. I've done it a couple of times with students there, do workshops for a day, and then they join for the concert in the evening. So,
I mean, you say concert, but, you know, Nicholas was saying as he came out, that concert, that, you know, why aren't more things like that? Why does it have to be, you know, the way you were playing with Purcell just seemed very, entering cliche land here, very honest to the spirit of Purcell, but with just a lot more sort of modern imagination. Why do you think you're, I wouldn't say the only person doing that, but there's a lot of weird projects in, you know, continental Europe and England as well, I suppose, but a lot of the time just strange things are thrown together in the hope that it'll make something cool. But what you do is much more organic than that. Why aren't there more people with that sort of playful spirit? Because it is playful, isn't it?
Well, definitely playful. If it's, I think, I can't speak for other people why they wouldn't do it. But I think my approach is definitely the playfulness, but also with a lot of respect for the original essence of it. So I have a deep love for Purcell and what he's done. So it's not just, oh, that's a cool, let's see what we can do with it. But so, because everything is there. And just think that there has been, for a long time, he's been misunderstood in many ways, especially maybe strings or like instrumentalists, because they have a tendency of treating him more like a Bach, or it was a very elevated, very like high brow, and he has the whole spectrum It's so much humour.
Funny, it's just what Sammy was saying yesterday, the mix of range. Can you think of another composer that goes from a dirty catch to something just so exquisite that you can't quite believe it?
I can't, certainly can't. I mean, I'm sure some of the things that you do with the Commedia has similar things, but it's not as easy to understand for our
audience. The advantage. The advantage you have with instrumental music is that it is timeless, and a lot of the music that I do, there's a context to it that one's constantly trying to reinvent.
But I also think that when you are Norwegian or not from England.
Not from England. Do the accent properly, please.
Not from England. It's much easier, you know, for me to sort of not have the weight of my cultural heritage on my shoulders. So it's easier for me to maybe...
I can see that excuse, but I just wonder whether we're just... No, it's not fair to call us lazy. There is so little money and so little rehearsal time, generally, with British groups, that, you know, one is struggling. And when I see something like that, I go back to the importance of not having to make a decision at the end of a session. It's like going to a library and getting the next book out from the one you wanted because it looks more interesting. And that ability to play. I mean, it just seemed like a big game, that Purcell Playground. And that's... So you don't feel... You know, there's been nothing... Oh, you know, I've done my bonne action, as my wife would say. I haven't been to a classical concert tonight. But it's also related to education. Sum up your music education in about 25 seconds. Why have you ended up like this, you weirdo?
25 seconds? Yeah. Are you joking?
Yeah, because very good discipline. It's like, explain your PhD in 30 seconds.
Well, I started playing violin when I was four years old, and I've gone through the music school system in Norway, very good place, and then into conservatory, too young. I should have had a matured a bit more, but I was always...
Yeah, we all think that.
Yeah, we all... Well, I'm 50 now, so... I've never felt at home with very traditional romantic violin music. Why should I spend 10 hours a day practicing just to sound worse than somebody else? Because you would never be better. So I was always interested in folk music and this sort of other types of music. So when I discovered early music in my life, in the early stages of conservatory life, it just clicked, because then you could have a combination of something serious, you can nerd, you can you open up all these fantastic worlds when you start digging into the material, and it's incredible how rich the early music is and how diverse it is compared to the classical, in the tradition that it's romantic, high romantic, and you just do something without question. And the link with folk music in early music, the use of improvisation, the complete crazy ideas some of these composers have had before everything became a European standard.
It's the 17th century, in other words. Yeah.
It's just mind-blowing how many directions you can get into.
So Bieber and that Costello sonata that you play on Monteverdi, the other Vespers, this... in which it was quite hard to follow you, I have to say, because you were so free with it. And we always ask ourselves, where did classical musicians lose the sort of play sense that allows them to improvise. And I think in England we seem to go down one route fairly early on, that either you become a sort of creating free musician, jazz, improvisation, or you go into classical. But you seem to have both because of the folk, I suppose.
I suppose so. I mean, I know jazz musicians that are really stiff as well. It's not that classical music or musicians by themselves is a stiff approach. I just think that there's so many traditions that you are thrown into once you say, okay, I'm really interested in Tchaikovsky. Well, then you have to do it. Like, well, why? And it's just easier in 17th century, 18th century, especially 17th century things to be free with it, because it's much more open and you don't have all this big interpreters before you. So you have to sort of rediscover. But if anybody doing anything with music or on stage, not forget that the same word for making music and having fun is play. You play music and you have fun. You improvise, you create things, you create small worlds.
Is that the same in German, in French, jouer, same, spielen
in
Norwegian?
In Norwegian, it's not the same.
Ah. Hoisted by your own petard, go and learn it's that phrase.
You spiller, you play music, spiller musik, and you leker. Leker, spiller.
Thank you.
Adagio on the Glittering Queen. That's the name of this track from Fairy Queen, although that instrumental movement is also in Hail Bright Cecilia, isn't it? Soprano there, Berit Norbakken. What an interesting sound and approach. She's got incredible articulation, hasn't she? And if you're thinking, oh yes, but there's a slight, you know, Scandinavian tinge to her accent. The older I get, the more I find that rather charming and interesting. It's a little trace element of something that isn't English. Do we get a little bit too concerned about pronunciation? Certainly as a singer and a director of an ensemble, I'm kind of manic about it at times. But actually, it's just a colour. And, you know, if the German ambassador comes onto the Today programme and has a slight accent, it enables us to place him, and that's fine. I just wonder whether we get a little bit fascist sometimes about insisting that the best performers of English music are English musicians, and especially vocal music, and you must have Spanish musicians performing Spanish choral music. Well, yeah, maybe, but maybe being outside, as Beata was saying, that you don't have the weight of expectation on you, and you come to it with something fresh. And, you know, I'd love to hear Al Aire Español singing Purcell and Concerto Italiano singing Wilks and maybe Yves Agilini singing, I don't know, German tenor leader or whatever we like. We should be a little bit free about that, I think. Fantastic to be out there working with Beata Eicher, and lovely to see Sammy as well, Nicholas Sammy. Thanks for listening. We'll be with you in a couple of weeks. Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.